I applaud your work on that.
Okay, here we go. I really like this approach, and because of what Steve just said, for one thing, and also I think it's simpler to have one zone as opposed to two when you can do that. I think the whole idea of introducing some flexibility for development here allows more creative designs. I think it's hopefully these will have more walkable areas, so we get people out of cars, less traffic, and all the impacts related to traffic. So I think it's great, and I think for Beaver Cove in particular, where you've just limited it to public and civic uses and facilities, and then home occupations is a good way to approach it for that particular area.
Anybody else on Beaver Cove?
Oh, we're back to Beaver Cove?
Well, I assume we are, unless your questions aren't answered yet.
Okay.
We should go through Beaver Cove.
Yeah, how do you want to do this? Do you want to say types of number of units? Are there questions, or do you want us to just jump in with our questions?
I don't think there's a need for me to go through this unless you have any specific questions.
Yeah. It wasn't our plan to have them make a presentation on each development zone. You guys, just if you've got questions that you've written down somewhere, just go ahead.
All right. Well, I guess it isn't so much a question, but the incorporation of the review process. The development review process. I think the language that you've used and the sort of the theory that you've used to approach the review process, I think makes a lot of sense. It's a little less confusing, I think, than that which was proposed, and it's also couched more in terms of language that I think is more understandable within the context of LURC. So I think that's a major contribution. I'd also like to talk about the disposition of undeveloped land for after 30 years, because this comes up in a number of instances.
Yes, it does.
In one of the iterations of Plum Creek's proposal, they were proposing that at the end of the 30-year period, when the concept plan goes away, that any land in development zones that wasn't developed would automatically fold into the conservation easement. Now, at first, I mean, I've had some concerns about this, and I noticed that they were noted in the record. While I think that at first blush that may seem like an easy alternative, just let everything sort of tip into the easement, I'm a little bit concerned about good planning principles, in the sense that what we're doing is we would then be essentially allocating all developable land into the future. And it just occurs to me that in 30 years, if Rockwood, for example, should develop as proposed in this plan and decides to incorporate, that it seems to me the citizens of Rockwood ought to have some control over what happens with their land base. And I think that's also true in perhaps Beaver Cove, and it's also true in areas that of intense development that may remain within our jurisdiction. So, I mean, I'm very much in favor of this. It doesn't say that the land will be developed, but it says that decision will be made according to LURC review criteria after 30 years, as opposed to automatically placing all that land into conservation easement. And as I say, I can see where a lot of people would find that very enticing to say, let's take all the land and stick it into easement. I just think that we have a responsibility to future generations and the people that live in that area to allow some flexibility so that we're not sitting here in 2008 and fixing the future. And in many instances, at least in certain portions of this plan, in perpetuity forever. So I just want to say that I find this a reasonable approach.
I agree with that. And I've only been on this commission for 21 years, and I think that's a long time. 30 years is a long time, and a lot of things change. So I like your approach.
I also agree with both Ed and Steve, and I think the other piece that I'd want to add in is that what this proposal recognizes that not all of the land that will be left over is equal. It's not all apples and apples relative to where they are, relative to current development, the natural resources that would be there, relative ability to be developed, and to put it all, to sort of dump it all into one bucket, doesn't allow for the kinds of things that, Ed just mentioned. So I think it's a very wise thing to allow those lands to be looked at individually at the end of the, either at the end of the 30 years or as we're going through this. There are several other options, but it does make sense to me.
You, I have another issue. Unless people.
Well, can I follow? Just
yes, please.
There were some. Well, I guess it's the on the question of the disposition of undeveloped land. It looks like you made in different locations. You made different recommendations for that.
Yes, that's right. The disposition of the undeveloped land is really the broad approach that we've taken is described under the planning and design components. Mm-hmm. Hold on, let me just find the page. It's on page 61, and we have approached this this idea of what happens of with any remaining undeveloped lands after the 30-year term of this plan would expire, very much case by case and location by location. And our recommendation to you is that there are four development areas where a permanent cap on development does make sense. However, we do not feel that the proposed approach by Plum Creek to put that into balance easement would accomplish that intent. And we are instead recommending an approach of restrictive covenants or easements on the land that would assure permanency of that cap in those four areas. And on the other hand, as Commissioner Laverty discussed, we do feel quite strongly that there are places here where a permanent restriction of on development would be harmful to the public interest and would create a situation whereby as communities develop and grow, they would be precluded from accommodating and planning for future needs within that community. And in particular, we are concerned that that would happen in Rockwood if any excess lands, of which there's quite a bit in that development area, would be put into balance easement. So there we are making recommendations to eliminate the expansion of the balance easement and actually, in fact, place some of that excess land in more or less a fallow state for the 30-year term of the plan in order to allow those communities and the LURC Commission 30 years from now to make good planning decisions for that community.
Go ahead, Ed.
I just wanted to, this also arises in subsequent areas, so I just wanted to bring this up now. We're talking here about 32 planned residential units, but yet the opportunity to transfer in additional residential units up to 975. Now, that's of concern, except that, and this is, I think one of the way I've worked through this, and I'm subject to comment from other people, but it seems to me that this is an area that, absent the concept plan, because of our adjacency criteria, would be subject to development, and would be subject to development, the intensity of which would be determined at the subdivision review level based on site-specific considerations. So I think that in certain areas, there are a couple other that we'll get to. It seems to me that at least what I've taken into consideration is if it is an area that could be developed and developed extensively absent this concept plan and meets our criteria for would meet our adjacency criteria for rezoning, then it seems to me that that's an area that I'm willing, I guess, to accept maybe more intensive development than I would in areas that don't meet the adjacency requirement. Does that seem like a logical approach to this?
That's entirely logical and very consistent with staff consultant thinking as well. There are a couple of points here that you're making. One has to do with the appropriate place for development and not placing artificial limits on those appropriate places if they are well-defined and not going to sprawl over the growth boundaries that have been identified. And that's what you focused on. We also did, as you may recall, an excess lands analysis back in late fall, early winter, where we looked at each zone, and based on different assumptions of lot size and intensity of use and frontages and things like that, tried to project reasonably whether a given area would have excess land in order to either be able to receive more units in transferred from the 975 and count towards those 975, or be available for a period beyond the concept plan horizon. And by combination of those things, the adjacency analysis to which you refer, the excess lands analysis which we did, we became comfortable with areas being receiving areas, as to use Plum Creek's language, versus those that should not be receiving areas. And I think we're very consistent. In the case of Beaver Cove, there are about 106 buildable acres. That's only going to be able to accommodate a certain finite number of lots or units. And my guess is that when all is said and done at Beaver Cove and they have designed 32 lots and the streets and common spaces that go along with that, there's not going to be much left over. Perhaps they would and should be free to transfer more in, but there's a finite limit here just by virtue of the fact that there are 106 buildable acres and no more, and they're going to need to accommodate septic systems and everything else. So there are natural limitations to a number of these areas, but the basic principle that you espouse is very consistent with our thinking.
Okay.
Commissioner Laverty, before you go on, I wanted to just go back to another historical note, because you made one on the excess lands, and I wanted to add another historical note, that in the previous version of the Plum Creek Plan, the concern you were raising about not precluding future generations was actually addressed by, you'll remember, there were buffer zones around the development zones that were for 30 years only, that were to accommodate it. And then when this version of the plan came out, they had, and so essentially you had three choices. You had a development zone, you had surrounding certain development zones, you had this 30-year buffer, and then you had permanent in perpetuity easement lands. In the version that came out in April, this version, before there was an amendment in October, it was down to two approaches, which was larger development zones to allow that capacity to expand after 30 years and not use it all up, and then in perpetuity easement lands surrounding it, the balance easement. And then what happened in October was the change in which part of those development zones that weren't developed would then go into balance easement. So I just wanted to make the point that going one historical step prior to what you went, there, Plum Creek did acknowledge that there needed to be room for future generations to decide. So what we're recommending is really that same policy, but accomplished within the development zones, a reservation of land in certain targeted development zones.
Thank you.
Thanks.
Ron, I don't want to complicate this any, but how is the question of the restrictive covenants, which caps the number of developments, number of units, as opposed to the excess land? It seems if you cap them, then there's no excess land, right?
Well,
how are you distinguishing between
them? I'm not sure if you're asking a policy question or a legal question. If it's a legal question, I think Jerry can
answer. How is this a policy?
Yeah, why don't you explain the thinking on where different choices were made?
We had thought carefully about whether the the approach of putting the, you know, any remaining excess lands into balance easement was the appropriate way to ensure that no additional development would occur in those areas. And we found several challenges with that approach. First of all, that approach would not preclude vertical expansion, in other words, upward growth or infill in these areas over time. And one might have a situation, for example, in one of these capped areas, let's just use Upper Wilson, where there's a 32 unit cap that would dissolve at the 30-year term of the plan, and new zoning would be established in that area. But those 32 units may be laid out in such a way to use up all of the lands within that zone through larger lot sizes, for example, or through a design that doesn't make it conducive to putting any of the lands into the balance easement. And that per se is not the problem. The problem is that if the commission feels that it's important to cap that area permanently and limit the ability to for the intensity of development to increase in that area, this approach would not achieve that, in our opinion. And that is why we were looking at other legal approaches that Jerry can more fully explain, if you wish, that would permanently cap the ability for new units to be developed in that zone or for units to be expanded into duplexes or multifamily dwellings, for example, that would increase the intensity of development on the same acreage.
Okay. Is there any other comments you want to make about Beaver Cove? Gwen?
I just have a question, probably a pretty simple one. What is the definition of caretaker manager housing? And it's all through here, and I didn't get a chance to look it up.
Yes, I think it's in the pocket part definition, but it's, and without looking at it, paraphrasing, it's housing of people who would be employees of the homeowners association hired to take care of the housing either in the wintertime when they're unoccupied or are there to do the landscaping or to take care of the variety of issues that come up with homes within a subdivision.
Do you have any concern about that being a loophole in any way?
I don't. It's a great question because it's that sort of thing is always ripe for a loophole. So in the actual language that will be developed after the commission has given the big picture directions, the language will have to be tight to make sure. Mm. Yeah.
That also, I mean, there's a host of different categories of housing units that are not covered by the 975 and the 1050, and that's certainly one of them. There's employee housing in addition to managerial housing, and there's affordable housing. So all of these things, I hope at some point we'll understand where they're going to go, or maybe we won't understand until subdivision stage. But when the world freaked about 975, this little piece hadn't come forward yet.
Any other specific comments or concerns about Lily Bay? Beaver Cove, we'll get there. I'm assuming the municipal concerns are taken care of in this. The new zoning you proposed allows the concerns the town of Beaver Cove raised about potentially needing a little more space for municipal facilities are allowed
right.
in this zoning you have?
Yeah, that's right. We're recommending, Plum Creek has proposed two MGN zones that are adjoin the property owned by the town for its town hall. Mm-hmm. And in total, they're about 10 acres, I believe. And we're recommending removing those from the MGN zoning that is proposed and putting them into this residential RS1 zone, as Evan mentioned, which does allow for public and civic uses.
Okay. If there aren't any other questions about Beaver Cove, I'm going to ask you to look at Wilson Pond, Upper Wilson.
If I may, I would like to highlight the few added lines to this recommendation that are new to Upper Wilson Pond that may be worth bringing to your attention. You will see.
Excuse me, Aga. New?
Yeah.
You mean they're not in here?
No, they are in here. Oh. I'm sorry. The elements that are distinct for Upper Wilson that did not appear in the Beaver Cove zone. You'll see page 6 outlines the numbers and types of units, the transfer, and the size and configuration as before, and our recommendations starting on page 7 on zoning, the review process, dealing with the excess lands. The last two rows of the table on page 7 are unique to Upper Wilson Pond. You will see a recommendation related to limiting shoreland structures, and that will be repeated in some of the other development areas as well. And something that is exclusively unique to Upper Wilson is its management class 4 lakes classification and our recommendation with respect to removing some added provisions that are currently in Chapter 10 related to preservation of additional open space within that development area. So I just wanted to highlight that is an element that is unique to this development area.
Aga, that last point you made, could you elaborate on that a little bit more?
Sure. Upper Wilson Pond is a management class 4 lake, which because of Lower Wilson Pond development patterns means that it is approaching, quote, heavily developed status. In the case of management class 4 lakes, LURC typically requires that subdivisions meet the requirements of Section 1025R, which is our open space requirement. And essentially what that means is that within the development area, 50% of net developable land and 50% of net developable shore frontage must be set aside as open space. The reason for that, the rationale behind that rule, was basically to prevent the type of ring around the lake development that has occurred in many southern Maine lakes and some mm-hmm. northern Maine lakes as well, whereby no preservation of shoreline occurred as development incrementally occurred along the shoreline. In the context of this concept plan, we felt that that objective had already been achieved through the proposed conservation of the remaining shoreline of Upper Wilson Pond, which is illustrated, I believe, on page 5, where you see that the entire east side of the lake and really going through the northern shoreline into the eastern side of the lake that is within Plum Creek's ownership is being proposed for conservation. And we felt that the remaining development area, which does meet the adjacency principle, in our opinion, and is sited on the west side of the lake, shouldn't be subject to additional open space requirements per se. Now, there may be a need to protect certain portions of the shoreline for natural resource protections to avoid a wetland, et cetera, but per se, we felt that the management class 4 objectives had been met, and therefore we're not recommending any changes to Plum Creek's proposal to strike that class 4 open space requirement.
And this is unique to Upper Wilson, right?
Yes, this is the only class 4 lake being proposed for development mm-hmm. within the plan area.
Aga, could you follow up with that, the second second section of that, the management class 4 lake requirements on eliminating Plum Creek's proposal to eliminating the clustering requirement.
Yeah, that's probably a wrong descriptor of Section 1025R. If you look at Chapter 10 and the actual requirements that are in Section 1025R, they are much less a description of what we all might envision as being clustering and much more of a descriptor of how to preserve the shoreline. So this recommendation is in no way an indication of our of a position that the clustering shouldn't occur here. In fact, good planning principles we would hope would be part of the design in this area that would make efficient use of land. However, Section 1025R is very specific to preservation of open space, in particular preservation of the shoreline, and that's the only reference being made here.
Okay. Ed, you got another question?
Well, once again, as you mentioned, this development area falls within, I think, arguably, reasonably, our adjacency criteria,
right.
And more intensive development than this could take place without the concept plan. I mean, at least it would be subject to approval based on our current standards. So I'm pleased that this has been limited. I'd like to see, quite frankly, no development here, but I think that, again, because of the adjacency criteria, where I think Plum Creek has proposed a cap here, I think we are pleased to accept their proposal. Having one access structure to the lake, I think, is important here, the recognition that what we're talking about is these 32 units are going to have one point of access to that lake, not 32 wharves or docks or whatever. So, I mean, while I'm, you know, I think that this is about the best we can do here. Having editorialized, would you explain, just so that we're all clear on this, why looking at the deed restrictions or the covenants as opposed to other mechanisms for preserving the cap? I know you mentioned this briefly before, but exactly how will that work in this instance of Wilson Pond?
I'm going to defer that question to Jerry if he doesn't mind.
I don't mind. Yeah, it's a good question. The term restrictive covenants appears throughout the staff recommendations in this context as the legal mechanism that we've chosen for the time being to accomplish the policy objectives that Aga has described very well. I'm still not completely certain whether restrictive covenants are the best legal mechanism to achieve those objectives. I'm continuing to look into that, and through the process, we'll make sure that we have the right mechanism by the end of it. But that's really an issue that I need to resolve. That's all I have to say about it for the time being. Does that respond to your question?
No, but it was a good response. You're looking for the appropriate, but the policy objective here is to cap at 32 in perpetuity, not just for
yes.
the 30 years, so that in the end
right.
of, at the end
right.
of 30 years, then we could have 100 more units.
Right.
The idea is to find some mechanism, the most appropriate, and I would assume the most efficient mechanism to achieve that end is what we're looking for here.
That's what we're looking for. And if we want to talk policy, I'm going to send it back to Aga. But that's right. The objective is to find the legal mechanism that is binding, that runs with the land, and that operates in perpetuity to accomplish those objectives.
Thank you.
And Commissioner Levitt, I might add, since Jerry's thrown it back, unlike in the Rockwood area, for instance, here we are firmly recommending to the commission that you should feel comfortable for all time, as you said, capping this area at 32 units, given its size, its location, the amount of land there, what's appropriate. And so our search, I guess it's from what I just heard from Jerry, it's somewhat of a not complete search yet, is for a real estate run with the land mechanism to ensure that that occurs, and if that is the commission's will, to give this commission the assurance that it will occur.
That would be important to me.
Steve?
I'd like to open the discussion at this time in reference to the shoreland structures, especially temporary docks, and what you're thinking, not just for Wilson Pond, but for the entire project, because and how it pertains, like for in Wilson Pond, how it pertains to, for instance, Rum Ridge and what their policy is and previous developments, if we're talking about adjacency, for instance. But I know it shows up several other times. And that, I think, it affects the value of waterfront lots to some extent, so I think it's important we talk about it as a commission, and because I think we are determining the value in some cases of these lots by this restriction. So if we could talk about what your thinking was there.
Sure, I'd be happy to do that. That's a great question. We looked at the issue of shoreland structures from several points of view or perspectives. First of all, Dave Roque, who is the state soil scientist, made some very specific recommendations with respect to the developability of the shoreline of some proposed development areas. And he raised concerns about having excessive shoreline access in some development areas with poor soils or with steep slopes that he has seen from his experience, I believe, have resulted in excessive shoreline erosions. And in those cases, he recommended a limitation on shoreline access. That, for example, is the main reason why we recommended a limit on docks on the Route 6 and 15 development, within the Route 6 and 15 development area. Secondly, we looked at the issue of shoreland structures from the viewpoint of what kind of impacts it might, excessive docks and other shoreland structures might create on recreational and scenic resources. And we relied on analysis conducted by James Palmer and Mark Anderson, our consultants on scenic and recreational resource impacts, to make the recommendations that we did in places, for example, like Upper Wilson, where both Drs. Palmer and Anderson found that this area has significant existing scenic and primitive recreational resources. And Palmer recommended a limitation on docking structures for that reason. In addition, specific to Upper Wilson, we did look at the Rum Ridge development on Lower Wilson Pond as a model for what might be appropriate for Upper Wilson. And we felt that that was an appropriate model that would allow for water access for the proposed 32 units without degrading the primitive resources that exist on that lake. So, anything to add?
The only other thing I would add is that in those places that we thought a limit was appropriate, we tried to come up with a number that could conceivably be within walking distance of all the homes in a development, so that there was a sense that each lot would have ready access to the water without having to go a long distance or around the other side of the lake.
And one last thing with respect to Upper Wilson in particular, we are not recommending the type of green belt common shorefront access, I mean common shorefront ownership that exists at Rum Ridge, for example. We do recognize that some of those 32 lots would likely have fee ownership of the shoreline, but we did feel it was important to limit the actual physical structures that could be placed on the shoreline in order to minimize impacts on scenic and recreational resources here.
And Commissioner Schaefer, one other thing. On a more general point, although I don't have the specific day reference, you'll remember Plum Creek's representative, Luke Muzzy, in his testimony. I believe it's in his written testimony, but I remember in his oral testimony generally indicating, and I'm not saying where they agree or disagree, but generally indicating a willingness to significantly limit a number of temporary structures throughout, and something that they were quite open and amenable to. And if you want to see that, we can dig for that specifically.
Can you tell me the legalities of the FPL shoreline and temporary structures? Is there an issue there? This is an overlying because it shows up again. So I just
that doesn't apply to Upper Wilson, but we can either discuss it now or defer that discussion to when we talk about the FPL lakes, which would be Moosehead, Brassway.
Okay,
and
that's
Indian
fine.
Why don't we hold that? And FPL has filed into the you'll remember they were asked that very question the hearings in December, and based upon that, they filed a letter with the commission giving their legal view on the legality of temporary structures crossing the public lands or the easement area in Indian Pond, and I can dig that up for you when we get to the low impact zone there.
Okay, well, that gives us a view of what's coming and how this is filtered through. I appreciate that. Thank you.
Any other comments on Wilson Pond? Are you comfortable with basically what's been proposed here? Let's see. I guess the next one is, Lily Bay. I don't think anybody has any concerns about that one, so we'll just go to the next one. So move. Okay. Estimate of the situation that perhaps Lily Bay is going to require a fair amount of discussion. So why don't we get a flavor of that? And then, as I say, this is one of the areas I thought that maybe we would have to defer until tomorrow when we could really get into it, because I'm sure there's a lot of issues here, and it deserves a full and thorough examination. So in the interest of moving through everything, but does anybody want to express some kind of broad issues the staff might be prepared for here? And
of course.
Mm-hmm. The whole thing, right?
Yeah, well, it's just that... First of all, do you have a visual for this? Do you have this map that's on page 8?
Hold on just a minute. We can put it up on the beamer. This is the concept plan summary map of Lily Bay. Map 8.
Of Lily Bay.